Right now, though, I'm looking forward to talking about this, especially with this guest. We're going to talk a little bit about immigration, legal as well as illegal immigration. And I'm happy to welcome anybody who has some ideas on the topic and some concrete ideas. So we welcome celebrated historian and author of the new book, Immigration, How to Avoid Its Perils and Make It Work. He's also the founder of History Speaks Today. We welcome Bruce Thatcher. Mr. Thatcher, thank you for being here.
Well, good afternoon, Chris, and thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
Terrific. Thank you. You know, before we get started on this, I got to say it to you. For people who do what I do for a living and everybody on TV and all the interviews that we see, I wish that we could radically change it, have the same amount of guests, but cleave off a third, maybe a half of the guests and replace them, same topic, with historians. Because we don't seem to ever learn from anything, and the only people who remember are the people who have dedicated their lives doing what you do. I'd love to have most of my guests be historians and also experts on a current topic.
Some of the most frequent comments I hear about history are that we never learn from history. And one of the things I'd like to do with History Speaks Today is bring history down into practical lessons. One of the reasons I think we don't learn is it's not taught as a practical lesson course. It tends to be a who, what, when, where, but never so what kind of course in schools.
Or even, sir, even a why in the who, what, when, where. You know, the why is not discussed enough. Why did he act that way? What pressures was President Rutherford B. Hayes under? Because it does factor it factors into today. I mean, I don't know how much President Hayes really added to the mix of what we're going through right now, but there is something there. And it's a real pleasure to talk to you. I'm going to make it my effort this next year to speak to many more historians on the same topics that we talk about, because too many people live in the present.
I think your readers will enjoy it, or your listeners will enjoy it. I
hope so, too. I mean, even the experts. You know, before we get into the meat of immigration, I guess I want to ask you that. It must be the most frustrating part of your profession. Other than the way the curriculum is taught, why don't we learn from history? Take a guy, maybe he didn't think much of history in high school, didn't take it at college. But as he got older, he started realizing it was important. He started reading it. What gets him to do that and so many others to not? Where can we get the interest in adults into, if I need to know what I'm talking about, I need to read this from then so I can talk about now?
It's a good question, and I don't know all the answers to it, but the way I got most interested in history, and it didn't start when I was going to school formally. It happened after I had been in business for many years. In school, it was kind of the who, what, when, where, and remember it by rote and spit it back kind of thing that you're familiar with, I'm sure, but not the so what. If we taught history more in terms of the so what's, it would be a more interesting kind of thing. If we insisted that in our schools that our students learn something and apply it to today, I think it would be a more interesting thing. But it isn't, and one of the reasons it isn't, I was told by a friend of mine who is a provost at a small university. He says, you know, liberal arts professors don't like practicality. They consider themselves above that.
Yeah, of course.
I don't know whether he's right.
Well, you can't advance the insane dream if you're going to be relying on practical foundations.
Yeah, something like that.
You know, I mean, how many times have you heard from that crowd, we're going to change history? That's a ridiculous statement.
Right?
You're going to really? How do you plan on doing that?
Yeah, history is what's going on right now.
Yeah.
Only we don't recognize it as history. History in business, all I learned about business and study about business is study in history. Pretty recent history, usually, but it's a study of what works and what doesn't work. And I think that history should be taught, at least in part, in the same way. What worked and what didn't work, and why.
Mr. Thatcher, I'm...
We don't...
I'm sorry, go ahead. Please continue.
Well, I was just going to say, I despair that we'll get to that point, but I think we should.
Okay. As far as trying to get more people to do it, you know, I'm mostly self-educated. I picked up whatever I could to learn about what it was. And I wonder what people in your position, a person who has dedicated his life to history, who is academic, feels about a citizen trying to educate himself by reading historical novels. And I would use the level of Herman Wouk, James Michener, maybe even Gore Vidal on that. Is there value there, even though obviously it is a novel, it's designed to entertain, and they probably have their own point of view on it?
Chris, amazing that you mentioned that, because I was just about to say, have them read novels.
Oh, no way.
novels, historical novels, the ones that are well-researched, and Herman Wouk does an enormously fine job, and Michener, there's a handful of writers who do an enormously fine job of researching the history that they put in their novels,
yes.
And we learn a lot from it.
Good.
And what it does, at least with me, it then sort of quenches, it's an appetizer. It makes me thirsty to learn more about this or that or the other thing that I'm interested in. And I think that if we had our students reading more, specifically historical novels, we would find a very much heightened interest in history.
Our guest is Bruce Thatcher on KMJ. He is the founder of History Speaks Today. And let's get to another good book, Immigration. This is his book, Immigration, How to Avoid Its Perils and Make It Work. Are we comprehensively opening with this, or would you like to go to legal or illegal immigration first?
Yeah. You know, almost everybody talking about immigration is talking about legal and, or rather, they're talking about illegal immigration. I was just seeing today that Senators Hutchison and Kyle introduced a bill in the Senate, which is they call the ACHIEVE Act. It's a variation of the DREAM Act. Mm. It's frittering around the edges, but it's all focused on what a tiny piece of what we call illegal immigration, and it gathers all of this conversation and all of this attention in that one little narrow area, and nobody gets around to talking about the overall problems and the real flaws in our immigration policy.
What are they going after?
I think we ought to talk about the policy.
What are they going after? Because it's going to get talk.
Well,
how have they narrowcasted it?
I'm sorry?
How have they narrowcasted it with this bill, the two senators?
Oh, what they're doing is they are proposing some variations to the DREAM Act that has been introduced in such a way that the students who will be able to stay here will not get an automatic path to citizenship, but they have to go back and get in line, even though they can stay here, to get into citizenship. That's probably the biggest thing on it, and they're also proposing a change in the lottery system that is a small part of the Immigration Act, immigration policy of the country. But they're minor changes, and they have no chance of being passed in the Senate. Kyle and Hutchison both admit that, but they propose it as a way to get the conversation started, and I think it may do that, but it's the wrong conversation.
Well, is it a way to get a conversation started, or is it a way to get noticed by your constituents? I sometimes wonder about that, too, because, I mean, we're talking about a Congress that's held 34 hearings on immigration. Nothing happens.
Well, yeah. In their case, it's probably genuine because neither of them stood for re-election.
Oh,
so they're done on January 20th. Yeah, on January 1st. It makes it harder for me to figure as to why we would waste time on it.
And if you're going to do that as your lame duck last cast, why not cast a big net? Yeah. Huh.
Yeah. I think that it would be much better for somebody in the Senate to stand up, or the House to stand up and say, okay, let's have a discussion on what should be the objectives of our immigration policy as a nation.
What?
And I'll bet you can ask all 415 members of Congress, and they can't give you any kind of a consistent answer.
Where should we be looking for that answer, sir?
Well, I think we have to have a national debate, and we won't get a national debate until it comes up in the Congress as the initial part of the hearings leading to a really comprehensive Immigration Reform Act. And I put quotes around comprehensive because lots of people are talking about comprehensive, but it always gets back to Dream Act and or amnesty. And they're not talking about anything else. And those are two small parts of the problem.
Why?
So if we could get the Congress to introduce a bill and begin to hold hearings, just as they did in 1965 on what was to be a comprehensive bill, then I think the question can get introduced and the debate can start on what should be the national interests that guide our immigration policy.
Here's what I worry about, Mr. Thatcher. This really worries me because you speak of amnesty. I don't think that congressmen and senators have any amnesty on this either. You talk about the Hart-Celler Act of 65, the Immigration and Nationality Act. I mean, that was at the height of just 65 was a terrible time in our country for race relations. And yet you would have been safer offering a comprehensive immigration policy then than you are in 2012, because the second you say anything somebody doesn't like about immigration, you're a racist. And if you're a congressman, that's a worry. You know what I'm saying? I mean, racism or the false racism that constantly is thrown at you as a weapon is going to be everywhere. And I think our president's going to lead finally with that.
Well, I'm convinced you're right. It dismays me, but I'm convinced you're right. We've gotten to the point in this country where most politicians' interest extends to the next election, and their reelection. And we don't see many with the courage to stand up and say, here's where I stand, and I don't happen to care whether I get reelected or not. This is what we need to do. I don't think we're going to hear that. I despair that we will, but if we could somehow or other get people talking about it, or get some of the national media and pundits talking about it in different terms, we might have a chance of inspiring some of the congressional leaders to do so also.
Mr. Thatcher, I'm going to go to break. I'd like to get breaking down into your ideas on how we can get this done, and also find out your work on just how much this costs us in the kind of economy that we're in right now. How much does broken legal immigration and, of course, utterly broken illegal immigration cost this country? I mean, what kind of different shape would we be in were it not for the drag on that? Bruce Thatcher is our guest, founder of History Speaks Today, and the book Immigration, How to Avoid Its Perils and Actually Make It Work. That's a positive statement. We'll see if he can back it up when we come back on KMJ. Mr. Thatcher, before I forget, because I sometimes do, picking up your book, the usual sources, or are there any other places special that a person could get your book?
Usual sources. You can get it direct from the publisher through my website, but, of course, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and so forth. It's available on all of those.
And no particular preference for you on that?
It's probably gets to you fastest and most directly by going through the website and getting it from the publisher, but they all work.
Terrific. All right. Let's get to it, talking about immigration, legal and illegal. We need to design immigration to serve a limited number of long-term national interests. And that's not a phrase I've heard too often, and I like it. Can you talk about it a little bit?
Sure. In the book, I've studied the immigration policies of eight different nations around the world through history, and all of them have in common, not the same ones, but all of them have only one or two or three at the most specific defined national interests that they've set out to serve with immigration. That's the case in Australia. That's the case in Singapore, and those are the most excessive. And that was the case for our first two immigration policies in the United States. So what I mean by that is two simple things. With Australia, during the first years of their history, during our first program, immigration was to serve population growth. We needed to people the land.
Yes.
And that was clear, and everybody understood that. And virtually all the laws attended to that objective.
All right.
Now we go to today with our current policy that started in 1965 and has been built on and patched together since then. There are at least different definable national interests that various parts of it are supposed to serve, and they contradict each other. So you can't, with that many, you can't, if you don't know where you're going, anybody will take you there.
I'm sorry. Could
that's
you,
where
could,
we are with our immigration.
Could you state the number again? Your phone clicked out right when you said the number of the policies we have now.
We have, going through, and I pointed out in my book, going through our current immigration policy, there are at least six clear national interests that are supposedly being supported by the policies.
And you say
some of them contradict.
And can you give an example of that?
Sure. The policy was originally, in 1965, a major mover for Hart-Celler was to, in quote, eliminate racial discrimination in our immigration policy.
Okay.
And so what they did was they changed the quota system, which gave preference to Europeans over the rest of the world,
yes,
to a system which has worked out and given huge preference to the rest of the world over Europeans.
Okay.
So we don't have the same racial discrimination or ethnic discrimination, but I would argue at least we have clearly just every bit as much preferences as we had then. That's one example. We said that we were going to put a policy together that would not change the demographic makeup of the United States. In the testimony before Congress, that was very clearly put forth. But in fact, since the policy has taken place and on an accelerating way, the demographics of the country have changed very significantly. Now, I don't say that's good or bad, but I do say that's not what the policy was supposed to do.
Okay.
We've given preferences to family. Over 60% of all immigrants come in under the preferences that are given to family members of existing immigrants who are in the country. And we also say we're going to have the immigration policy support the economy. And to a large extent, those two conditions contradict each other very much. So
yeah,
those are some examples of it.
One of the other things that was mentioned are the three things in the Hart-Celler Act of 65, end discrimination, as you mentioned, preference to family members, and then this, those with desirable skills. I would think that is almost an unspoken or no need to speak part of it, of any sensible immigration policy, but is it still in there? I mean, is it still something that is truly
in the law?
It's still in the law. But for that person trying to come from Spain with a doctorate in molecular biology who can't believe he still can't get in, are his skills being considered?
Well, if he's willing to wait for 17 years or whatever the waiting list is for his group of people, the amount of red tape. Well, first, there's only 10% preference given to people with those kinds of skills. It's very small in terms of the total number of immigrants, by the law. But then apart from that, everybody who comes in under the various skills parameter has to get in line. They have to apply in their own country, and then they have to get in line and wait until their slot comes up. And the waiting periods run from 3 to, I use the term, 17 years. That's really true in many cases.
Oh, my.
It's just enormous. You practically tear your hair out saying, how can we be supporting our economy with special skills by doing that? The DREAM Act is trying to attend to part of that, particularly the one introduced by Kyle, by saying, okay, let's take the people who are attending universities in this country,
yes,
and once they graduate, let's not kick them out, which we now do, but instead let's let them be immigrants.
At that point, and you have to complete, and that seems a fair deal.
Yeah, well, it more than fair, and I'm going to sort of say, let's set aside fair. What I want to know is what is in the best interest of our country,
fair or not.
And it is in the best, fair or not, because the definition of fair can be widely interpreted. If it's in the best interest of our country that these people should stay here after they've been trained here, then let's help them stay here.
And on the other example, are you suggesting, and I think you are, a person with just an unbelievable skill set, he's from Austria this time, unbelievable skill set, he reads English proficiently and he is fluent in the spoken language of English, he comes with multi-doctorates and a tremendous desire to work here, why can't we fast track him? Why does it take longer than, give the bureaucrats their paperwork, more than 2 weeks to do that if he's got the funds to do it? And especially if he has the funds to do it. These are the people that don't get talked about, and I don't understand what happens.
We have our immigration laws are such an incredible, incredible mishmash of complexity.
Yes.
It takes a lawyer to go through them. People who want to immigrate to the country, and I know some of them personally, have to hire lawyers to figure out how to get through the process. And the bureaucracy allows 100 people who have the ability to say no in the process for every one who has the ability to say yes. I don't know that those numbers are accurate, but my point is almost everybody in the bureaucracy can put blocks in the way.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think that's the way they show their power, by doing that. It's incredible. One of the Australia was having that kind of a problem too, a number of years back. And when they rewrote their immigration laws, in order to get around a lot of that bureaucracy, to get around a lot of that red tape, and frankly, to get around a lot of judicial muttering around with the laws or the regulations, Australia wrote virtually all of their procedures into law, so that there was very little administrative decision to be made other than administering the law.
Interesting.
And it has made things so much smoother for them.
That is truly interesting.
It's one of the things that I absolutely would recommend that we do here to get past all of the backlogs and all of the delays. Let's write them into law.
Because what you're saying is basically with the vagaries and the contradictions, okay, that person has landed on our shores or is applying to land on our shores. He is really facing the lowest common denominator when it comes to the bureaucrat that's going to handle his paperwork and the vagaries that they encounter as well, right? And so he just dies in a paper drowning.
Yeah, or he really hangs on for a long time.
Let me ask you that, Mr. Thatcher. By the way, we are with Bruce Thatcher. He's the founder of History Speaks Today at historyspeakstoday.com, where you can find the book, Immigration, How to Avoid Its Perils and Make It Work. You can also find the book at the usual sources like Amazon. If you know, what it, on average, in terms of time, but especially cost, does it cost a person who wants to come from Slobovia and come to this country with a reasonable skill set? What does it cost them?
I don't know on average, but let me give you an example.
Sure.
With somebody I know. Somebody who came from Singapore, college degree. They came to this country to go to work.
Uh-huh.
And they went to work for a company out in first in New York and then in Washington. And she began applying as soon as she got here. She came on a temporary visa, and then she began applying for a permanent visa to stay in this country and work. It took her 8 years.
Oh, God.
8 years to go through the process. She just got through it 6 or 8 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
She had to hire a lawyer about halfway through that process and pay a lawyer because she just couldn't figure it out. She was getting nowhere without having an immigration lawyer who knew where all the little bodies were buried and all the pieces were to go to get through the process.
Did she ever consider, Mr. Thatcher, in her frustration, just going to TJ and crossing the river? I'm sorry, there's no river at Tijuana. going to Juarez and just crossing the river?
Well, what happens is, and this is the interesting thing, if she came over here on a temporary visa and got a job, and then her employer put through to have her hired, to have her get a green card so that she could stay here permanently.
Yes.
As soon as you do that, as a temporary, once you're in the country and you make that application, then they can't ship you out. So she can stay here until her application is either approved or denied. And during the years it's in limbo, it's in neither one. So she can just stay here. But, of course, she doesn't know for sure what's going to happen at the end of the road.
Wow. I want.
Is that incredible?
I wonder, you know, because our illegal immigration problem in the United States and here in California, I know you know, it's even tougher. That doesn't mean we don't still talk about the problems of legal immigration. And I know you are here and your book is very much promoting comprehensive across the board change. But is there any hope at least for changing for the benefit of our country, to enrich our country with these valuable people, to fixing at least legal immigration? It seems like it's all bureaucraties, and that could be done in one fell swoop the way Australia did. Do you think there's any hope of solving just legal immigration if comprehensive action isn't possible?
I think, well, first, if we solve legal immigration, we'll have most of the problem solved, and then the illegal part will be easy to deal with. But if we can't get ourselves to start talking about our real immigration policies and what has to be done with them, I don't know if there's hope.
All right. That's just so sad. I mean, I if it were me, 2 years in, I'm crossing the river.
I send letters to congressmen, my own, and sometimes I try to send them to others.
Yes.
On the subject, and I offer ideas. Usually what I get back is a form letter, standard reply, that shows the congressman or senator hasn't really, maybe somebody in his staff looked at it, but he hasn't even looked at it. And I'm getting this answer back. It hasn't even answered the issue that I've raised. And if we can't get our legislators to consider anything other than what they already have their minds on, I sometimes think there's not much hope.
But at least the reply, the form letter you got back was in English and Spanish, right?
actually not, because I sent my inquiry in English.
That doesn't stop us in 2012 America. Have you got a little bit more time?
Sure.
I just wanted to ask you a couple more things about assimilation, and I'm dying to know what one at least of the countries that you studied, of the eight that Mr. Thatcher did in his book, again, Immigration, How to Avoid Its Perils, and Make It Work. A couple more minutes when we come back with Bruce Thatcher. Historians are my favorite guests. I hope that you're enjoying it as well. Mr. Thatcher, you brought up that you studied eight different countries' immigration policies, and I'm dying to know, was one of those countries Mexico?
Well, actually, it was. It was Mexico's first immigration policy, which started in 1821, right after they became an independent nation.
Yes.
And they constructed a specific immigration policy to preserve what we now call Texas as part of Mexico, because they were fearing an influx of North Americans into that country, and they felt that they might lose it.
Yes.
So they put together an immigration policy with a clear objective, but the execution, as we all know, the execution was very flawed. They lost Mexico anyway.
They lost it anyway.
They lost Texas, yeah. But Mexico was one of them, and ever since then, their immigration policy has been a very restrictive policy.
As it is today. Good luck trying to immigrate to Mexico. You better have your ducks in a row. You got to have a job. You've got to have money. I believe it's for a year, according to some standard. You got to have some cash in your pocket. I don't believe they ask that you speak Spanish, although I don't think anybody's going to help you.
Well, yeah. I don't know whether they ask that you speak Spanish. I can't remember that, but all legal activity takes place in Spanish. You can't read a law in English.
Exactly.
Everything is in Spanish. So Mexico has a very restrictive policy, and I sort of look at it and I say, well, that might have something to do with what they learned with their flawed policy way back in 1820 to 1830. But I've looked at other countries as well. Australia is one of them. Their first immigration policy allowed people in who were exclusively all right, already like the people who were there. It was a white Australia policy.
Yes.
And you mentioned assimilation. With that policy, they didn't have any problem with assimilation because everybody who came there was pretty much like everybody who was there already. But in in 1972, they saw the need to change the policy because they had to do business in the Pacific, particularly with Asian countries. So they completely turned around the policy and said, all white is out. Now we're going to encourage non-whites to come in so that we have a representation of races and that we can do business more effectively in the markets where we choose to do business. When they did that, they also put in place specific programs to help assimilate the people who were coming there who now were no longer quite so readily assimilated naturally.
Yes.
They recognize the importance of assimilation.
And
Singapore.
Let me stop you there because we're getting tight on time, and you actually have two callers holding too. But forgive me, but you know, you talk about assimilation. You're very much for it. It was our policy. It was a policy embraced by our immigrants for 100 years. They couldn't wait to assimilate. But now I fear, Mr. Thatcher, that it's going to become a dirty word, back to being called a racist, because I'm insisting that you assimilate instead of forming some sort of pod inside one of our metros. Do you think assimilation is becoming a dirty word?
I think it is becoming a dirty word, and you can see contra assimilation activities going on all the time. We celebrate Mexican holidays that they don't even celebrate in Mexico, and we make them part of legal holidays in this country.
And look at the pods of Middle Eastern immigrants in London that are basically setting up their own mini governments inside neighborhoods.
They walked away from assimilation.
Let me stop you there. I want to get these callers on. We asked them to call, and we're giving them very short time here, Mr. Thatcher. In Fresno, Matt, you're on with Bruce Thatcher.
I hope. I'm sorry. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
And Mr. Thatcher. One thing I wanted to mention was the chain migration. My family's gone through that on the Filipino side, and it's ridiculous, the sponsorship and then having to wait to get your green card and then you have your life in the Philippines, and 20 years later they say, oh, here's your green card, now you can come over. And by that time your child's aged out, you have a good job, and what do you do? Come over here and have no job?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. That part of our immigration policy needs to end, and paying particular attention to the H-1B visas, educated people, they need to come over here is my belief.
Matt, thank you very much. Mr. Thatcher, you have a response on that? You know what? Hang on, Matt. I'm going to park you there, and I forgot I was in the FM studio, Mr. Thatcher. I didn't have a chance. Did you hear the man's question and comment?
I didn't.
You didn't, and we have a small phone problem here. We are unable to take both at the same time on this system, is it? Can you? Shoot, I don't know quite how to solve this problem. what have you got?
I talked to Matt.
You did. Did you hear what he had to say?
I did, indeed.
Okay.
I agreed with him.
You agree? Do you have a comment for him on that other than agreeing? Because I'll move on to our next caller.
Well, my comment was just that chain migration is a big part of the problems that we have here, and we do need to solve them.
All right, very good. And we have about 90 seconds left. Greg, I'm going to ask your question for you without getting the details because we have about 60 seconds. Greg is asking Mr. Thatcher, Dad was deported decades ago. Can I bring him back to the United States?
Greg, I'm not an immigration lawyer, so I can't say for sure whether you can or not. But in general, people who are deported, with some exceptions, people who are deported do not have the option to come back. I know there's some exceptions to that, but I don't know what they are.
And I'm going to ask my last question then briefly, Mr. Thatcher. You know what? Actually, I'm wrong. Forgive me. I got kind of tumbled out there on the phone problem, and I'm out of time. So I'm going to thank you for the time. I'd love to have you back. And again, thank you for being a historian willing to do talk radio interviews. I really appreciate that. We learn more from you than anybody.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure being here, and I'd love to come back.
Okay, again, the book is Immigration, How to Avoid Its Perils and Make It Work. You can find it at historyspeakstoday.com or at the usual Amazon, Barnes & Noble kind of places.